Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin from Chicago, and this is one of the good days if you happen to tune in. We've got a little Grateful Dead for you like we always do. We have some other live music that I think our guest will enjoy. We've got some marijuana news, but most importantly, we have a wonderful guest on our show today, folks. Nick Erickson from Full Moon Farms in California. We're going to get to him in 1 minute. But we are going to also be taking a look at what the Grateful Dead were doing 52 years ago today at the New York Academy of Music on their hangover in New York, or layover in New York, probably a hangover too, while they waited to take off for Europe for the always famous Europe 72 tour. So we're going to kick right into it and start you off with a doozy. How Sweet It Is to Be Loved By You is a song recorded by American soul singer Marvin Gaye from his fifth studio album of the same name, released in 1965. It was written in 64 by the Motown songwriting team of Holland, Dozier, Holland, and produced by Brian Holland and Lamont Dozier. The song was inspired by one of the actor and comedian Jackie Gleason's signature phrases, "How Sweet It Is." And probably right along with asking somebody if they're old enough to have ever seen Jerry Garcia, you can ask them if they're old enough to even remember "How Sweet It Is" by Jackie Gleason. James Taylor released his version of "How Sweet It Is" as the lead single from his album Gorilla in 1975. His 1975 single has been the most successful remake of the song to date, hitting number one on the Easy Listening chart and number five on the U.S. Billboard 100 chart. In addition to James Taylor on lead vocals, other personnel include his then-wife Carly Simon on vocals, Danny Korchmer on guitar, David Sanborn on saxophone, Clarence McDonald on piano, Fender Rhodes electric piano, and possibly ARP string ensemble Lee Sklar on bass, and both Jim Keltner and Russ Kunkel on drums, with Kunkel doubling on the tambourine. Author Ian Halperin believes that the song was included on Gorilla as a tribute to Simon, who was then his wife. It was produced by Lenny Waronker and Russ Tittleman. After his success with How Sweet It Is, Taylor continued to record R&B hits, applying his soft touch approach. That's quite a lineup of people to be playing with him, but James was a player at the time. And although this song was a regular for the Jerry Garcia band, and often a song that Jerry would come out and open his shows with, this is the one and only time it was ever played in concert by the Grateful Dead. So, first show, this show. Last show, this show. How many times played? Just one. And here we are. It's that kind of a day. This is really a good show, and I wish we had more time to go over all of it, because, as I say, it is on their way out the door to Europe. It's in a very small theater in New York City, and part of it has been released by the Grateful Dead on, I think it's Dick's Picks number 30, if I'm remembering my Dick's Picks correctly. But it's well worth listening to. We're only going to probably pull up one more song at the end, and we have another musical highlight in the middle of things that's going to come from a different band for reasons you'll find out when we get there. But yeah, this is just the Grateful Dead doing their thing and going out there and really laying it down. It's a beautiful song from a beautiful time, and it's a damn shame that Jerry didn't play it more with the band. That would have been a lot of fun. One other note I just want to throw in there, as was probably obvious for those of you who are veteran enough to know what I mean, this is an audience tape. and just an audience tape. And it was posted on archive.org as an audience tape. So it's not a CD, kids. It's not a remaster. It's not something where all the... This is what we had to listen to the Grateful Dead like for years and years. In the 80s and early 90s, if you wanted to listen to live Grateful Dead, you traded tapes with people. Some tapes were better than the others. So, you know, there's shows I had from way, way back that were awesome shows, but the tape recordings basically sucked. But that's what you had to live with. So sorry that this is not a show where, you know, you're getting that technical, clear musical sound. But rather than blame it on our producer, Dan Humiston, we will just go with the fact that it is an audience tape. And also, very interestingly, it turns out that this show on March 25th of 1972 is the first time that Donna Jean Gauchow joined the boys on stage. Her husband, Keith, had already been playing with them for a while, dating back to the, I want to say the fall of 71, I think. He, of course, was coming in to take over the keyboard duties. Pigpen is still with them in this show, and we will actually be highlighting a Pigpen tune towards the end. And then he did go with them on to Europe 72 tour, but came back, and that was pretty much the end of it, unfortunately, for Pigpen in terms of having the strength and ability to go up on stage and perform. And for better or for worse, the Dead moved on without him. And Keith is a great piano player, and Donna Jean has her moments as a backup singer. And they've all done a really good job, the keyboard players, but you know, nobody was Pigpen, and nobody could belt out a blues tune the way he could. You know, he didn't have the range on the keyboards that a Keith Gauchow or a Brent Midland or even a Vince Welnick had, but he was damn good at what he did. So it's always important to be sure to mention him and give him his due, because over the course of time, he just didn't seem to get enough of it. So we will get back to live music in a few minutes, but we are going to now jump right into our guest for the day. And I just want to tell you how excited we are to have Nick Hernandez on our show. Erickson, sorry, I had it right, and then I didn't think I did. Nick Erickson on our show. The guests we've had typically over the last year or so have tended to fall much more on the musical side, which is great. We've been very lucky to have wonderful, wonderful musical guests, but it's not often that we have an opportunity to take a few minutes and chat with somebody like Nick. Nick is an original, an OG from way back in the day, a legacy grower. We're going to talk with him for a little while right now about his marijuana experiences and the state of marijuana and anything that he's willing to share with us about his cultivation efforts. Then we will, in the second half, focus our conversation a little bit more on music. And I find very interesting the role that Nick has been able to play in the music industry. And it's no surprise that his two big passions link right up. And we will be hearing about that. But first of all, Nick, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today. We really appreciate it. It's great having you here.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's an honor. You know, like I said, when we met there at the gallery, you know, I'm an avid listener of the show, and I'm always learning facts from you guys. So to be on here and hopefully have your listeners learn something from me, that's an honor.
Well, thank you. We certainly appreciate all of that. For our listeners, there's a full podcast connection that runs all the way through this. I was lucky enough to meet Nick just about a month ago, maybe not even a month ago, maybe just a few weeks ago in San Francisco. The wife and I were out there for her birthday, and we were visiting various friends, including Alex and Andy, both very good friends of the show, who are also good friends with another good friend of the show, Jay Blakesburg. And I think I mentioned on last week's episode about Jay's absolutely amazing photo exhibit at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco, and that my wife and I went and saw the exhibit and then had a very unique opportunity to walk back through it again with Jay as kind of our personal guide. We weren't the only ones, though. We had Nick and one of his friends with us, too, and that's when Nick and I first met. And, you know, once you start talking marijuana with a guy who really knows marijuana, folks, it's hard to stop. I mean, you know, this guy's answering all the questions I always have and was gracious enough to agree to come on the show. So, you know, tell us, Nick, tell us, first of all, a little bit about Full Moon Farms. What's its background? Where is it at today? What role do you play?
So, you know, my family has been in California since 1853. They came over for the gold rush. That didn't really pan out so well. And, you know, they stayed with it with farming and all the blue-collar kind of Northern California work, ranching and timber and those kind of industries. My ancestors were set, like I said, seven generations deep. The first farm that we picked up, they were trading vegetables, you know, for their balloon payment, because California didn't have a currency yet. And, you know, it was a raw and rugged land, and money didn't really do a whole lot for you here anyway, but substance did. So we have like some of the old deeds where they're trading like X amount of pounds of potatoes and carrots and those types of things for the rights to the land. You know, progressing onward, my great-great-grandmother was a fabulous moonshiner and outlaw, and I heard that we would have been wealthy from her if my great-great-grandfather didn't drink everything. And then, you know, going fast forward into the 70s, you know, my dad always had plants in the backyard, so I grew up around plants. You know, the cannabis was mixed into our vegetable garden, and it was always just personal stuff, you know. He might trade for some hash or something like that, but it was always familiar to me. It wasn't ever deemed something as a negative or something that should be hidden from us. My swing set was set up out there to where I could kind of kick my feet up through the fan leaves. And in 1978, under the guise of a bunk warrant, which he later got off on, you know, the cops came in and ripped up the plants, were stepping all over our garden, you know, overturning our house. I was young. And wasn't quite sure what was going on, you know. And it to this day, that's still my earliest memory in life. And I don't know if it's just the trauma of it or what, that just kind of seared it in. But I vividly remember, you know, the cops coming in and yanking my dad's plants out. And I was escorted to a toy store where they got me a little Tonka truck to kind of calm me down. You know, and then my dad parked that from when he got off.
That's not bad.
Yeah, but from that point on, you know, he didn't have it around me. When he smoked somewhere else. He didn't have it around me from that point on. You know, I, you know, get into the elementary and high or junior high era. You know, I had friends with older brothers and sisters. You know, they're always introduced us to, you know, different types of music. You know, from the early 80s, you know, you'd have older brothers, you know, handing you Twisted Sister or something like that, or, you know, Quiet Riot, you know, and you were. And I was probably one of the only eighth graders that had this, like, really eclectic, you know, set of tapes. You know, I had, you know, Buddy Guy and Robert Johnson. I was probably the only eighth grader listening to, like, true old school blues back then. But I also, you know, whatever was popular at the time, you know, like a lot of outlaw country music, classic, what's deemed classic rock now, you know, The Dead, everything. But, you know, also, you know, Motley Crue, Allman Brothers, Eagles. I was all over the board. But also getting those tapes handed down to us, you know, came cannabis. And at the time, you know, it was mainly just brickweed coming across the border from Mexico. In 1988, I popped my first seeds, tried my hand at growing my first plant. I sent you a photo of that. I didn't even know how to sex it out. I was just lucky that the
one. Your dad let you go ahead and do that?
No, this was all me sneaking out the back door and going up on the hill, because our backyard bordered mountains, and so this was just me going up and doing it kind of outlaw style on my own before I knew what was going on or what the risks were or anything like that. I was pretty naive to all that. You know, I just knew it would be cool to try to grow this plant, and that's all I really knew about it. And I was lucky enough that it was female, so it started to bud out. Obviously, it's a sativa, and it wasn't going to – a true sativa, and it wasn't going to finish out in time for me. And, you know, I packed all my friends up there to show them what I was doing and show it off a little bit. I was really proud, and one of them ended up coming up a couple weeks early and taking it from me. And I, from what I understood, he microwaved it to dry it out, and that's how he ingested it, and I lost my first plant. So right away I learned loose lips sink ships, you know, and that whole thing. And that was my first experience with cannabis. I got to grow a plant, it got taken from me, and lessons learned, and we progressed, you know. So, you know, 1993, I was living on a beanbag at Humboldt State, and, you know, we'd introduced to, you know, good quality green bud, which at the time was, you know, $5,200 a pound, you know, big discrepancy from the $400, $500 you're seeing in California these days. You know, magic mushrooms, those type of things. So we had a friend, you know, that I was living out of the back of a van with on tour, and we'd hit Humboldt and get back out on tour and trade, you know, good green bud and some magic mushrooms for grilled cheese sandwiches in the lot, and trade for tapes and get tickets and that type of thing. And we weren't just following the dead. We were following, you know, Page and Plant, and there were some other people that were doing West Coast tours, and everything was West Coast. You know, we we were pretty in the dark to what was going on back east. I never made it to any of the East Coast shows. But your information traveled a lot slower back then as well. It wasn't as available. So it's just everything was kind of word of mouth and that type of thing. And with the Dead, you know, there was a large West Coast presence. There was a lot of shows and stuff happening out here. So, you know, and then progression, you know, I got into the outlaw era of cannabis and, you know, went through my bumps and bruises, you know, and the good days and the bad days and everything that came with being a legacy farmer, you know, until 2016. And my, you know, with like every outlaw farmer, you have to have a good legal defense. And my defense attorney came to me and said, hey, you know, we're going to be looking at California legalizing next year. Let's step into the light and start dotting the I's and crossing the T's and get you guys ready. And I had, you know, a pretty good mentor with him. And we started about a year before legalization getting prepped for it. And then it launched with a lot of optimism. Everybody had these grandioso visions of where craft cannabis should be. And, you know, that all kind of fell apart fast, you know, and it's just been a struggle and survival mechanisms happening ever since that, you know, and we're seeing it now. We're starting to see the separation. Right now, the craft and the commodity cannabis markets are pretty tied to the hip price point wise, but not quality. And so, you know, just, you know, educating up and why, you know, sun grown is what it is, why organic's better and why, you know, and these, the whole notion of indoor farming, you know, when the helicopters were hitting us really heavy in the 80s and 90s, that drove a lot of the people out of necessity. You know, we're out in the hills, we adapt, you know, we can roll with these punches, but everybody went underground and we called it the, you know, the diesel days. And everybody had their diesel generators to power their lights. We were all off grid anyway. And out of necessity, we were farming underground indoors. And, you know, since legalization, there's really not a need for that, but somehow that just turned into the cookie cutter, you know, go-to for every state in the industry. So now everything's in warehouses, where that dichotomy seems really strange to me when you're talking about a plant that can heal so much and do so much, you know, remediating the land and all this kind of thing, to where it's just a big drain on the system. And, you know, we're growing soilless, you know, in rock wool and pumping chemicals and running these lights. And that's okay if that's where people want to be, but that's not us. And so we need to see these markets separate, you know, because we're a whole different, you know, whole different animal.
Let me ask you this. I mean, that I could just listen all day, but I just want to throw a couple of questions in here. You know, the area you're talking about where you were at, I know is up in Humboldt and yes, the Emerald Triangle, and, you know, famous for what it isn't for so long. When your family decided to, you know, kind of stay in the Humboldt area, was it because of the presence of marijuana? Was it there just other reasons and they just happened to be growing marijuana in there? And how was it that, you know, you or your father, or, you know, both of you kind of ultimately found your way into not just growing for personal use, but, you know, large enough amounts to be able to sell?
Yeah, that one's pretty much on me. My dad, he grew up in the Plumas County area. It was back where, like, High Sierra Music Festival's at. It's in the Sierra Nevadas more. My great-great-grandfather on his side was up here in the early 1900s in Humboldt for timber, like when the 06 earthquake happened in San Francisco and they had to rebuild San Francisco. There was a big logging boom to get timber down to San Francisco and start rebuilding. He was part of that. Prior to that, on my mom's side, her family was more on the Mendocino coast, again, timber, cattle. And those were really the only industries up here at the time. I came over in 93. And, you know, and Full Moon Farms, literally that is sprouted with me. That was my personal vision, you know, and my dad and I partake, you know, when I turned 18, I sat down with him and, you know, brought him back a nice green bud, 'cause he was used to smoking the brick, and we passed the peace pipe and went from the kind of a father son to a friendship level when we did that. And, you know, to this day, you know, I won't try to market anything that we grow that I wouldn't feel proud enough to smoke with my own dad.
That's very cool.
You know, morally, you know, if it's not growing properly, if it's not up to a certain standard, it shouldn't go to the market.
Okay. Let me ask you this. What has it been like, you know, to live in a community where growing marijuana is such a major part of of the community and of the economy. And I know you've gotten involved from time to time in some of the local organizations, but tell us a little bit about that and a little bit about the relationship with your local law enforcement.
You know, it's both a blessing and a curse. You know, from the outlaw era, you know, there was fewer people growing up here because the penalties were so severe, but the rewards were greater. So you had more of a sense of community. You had families that were multi-generation. You had the back-to-landers. You had people that were making enough extra money but living, you know, off the grid. They were supporting their community centers. They were supporting their schools. You know, there was a lot more donating going on. It was more of a sense of a community, kind of like us against them also with the law enforcement. You know, every season was cat and mouse. You know, they were out to get you. Their budgets depended on their plant counts. You know, hippies were the green dopers, they'd call us. You know, we're the low-hanging fruit. We live here. If they catch us, we're going to pay our bills. We're not running away somewhere else because we love where we live. We love our land. So we're not disappearing on them. We're easy targets. You know, we're not sitting there shooting back, even though they're dropping out of helicopters with, you know, AR-15 strapped to their backs. You know, it was overtime for them. It was, you know, hazard pay for them. It was, you know, the summers of fear for us. But it bonded us as a community, you know, and we always revolved around a annual reggae event called Reggae on the River. It's the United States' largest reggae festival, second largest in the world outside of Jamaica. Wow. And it was in August, first week in August. They're bringing it back finally this year, which I'm super happy about. But, you know, it got everybody kind of come out of the hills. And, you know, people didn't like to use phones. We're definitely not on the internet. So you got to see your friends, you know, share your wares. You know, what are you growing? You know, are you making some hash? You know, and everybody got together and just puffed and enjoyed some music and community and then back to work, you know, because it was still kind of pre-harvest. But so, you know, there for a long time, law enforcement, you know, they were definitely on us. They were definitely on us. And you know, there was some showboating going on too. You know, if you saw like a 16-year-old driving a $50,000 rig towing a $80,000 boat and that sheriff is making $40,000 a year, there's some resentment there, you know, when the money was higher, but that wasn't everybody. But those kind of things happened. And so we all kind of got blanketed into the same pool, sure. Right? If you grew dope, you know, you're probably messing up the environment. You're probably, you can pay your fines. We tax you a little extra hard this year when we come to your house and knock on your door and that kind of thing. So there was a different mentality amongst growers, but we all got treated the same.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Were you ever, was your farm, Full Moon Farms, were you guys ever the subject of a raid?
Oh, multiple times, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
What's that like?
It's scary. I mean, we would get flown the helicopters, you know, and back then, you know, especially in the early 90s, mid-90s, it was all Hueys. So you could hear them coming up the canyons a long ways away, and you would have that whoop, 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 that just that signature sound, that thump, and it resonated, you know, and you had to, you'd run by your truck, you'd drop your tailgate so that your tailgate was blocking your license plate so they couldn't read your license plate. You'd take cover. You know, they would hover you 3, 4, 5 times a summer, even if you didn't get raided. They were just kind of putting your X on the map for maybe next season. Out where I'm at, you know, our hill would get hit about every third year. And they wouldn't make arrests. They would just drop in, cut your stuff, get out. You know, they were going for plant counts. So it was just a real quick operation. They weren't doing a lot of background work unless there was something real egregious. Yeah, so we would get raided a lot. You know, in 2012, I actually had them come to my door. That was a whole different chaotic scene. You know, I mean, I knew who it was by the knock at 7 in the morning. It was very, very strong and rapid. You know, they had their signature knock. So I knew who was on the other side before I opened it, and that was my first arrest.
I was going to say, how many times have you been arrested?
Just the once.
Oh, good. Okay. So that's not bad.
And, yeah, but, you know, it would be fair to say that a lot of product never made it to evidence either. You know, we had there were sticky fingers everywhere.
Got
there.
It.
And you know.
Okay.
Yeah. So wow. So that's how that goes.
For sure. Well, let me ask you this. Forever there was California weed, right? And then, you know, people grew marijuana in other parts of the country, and sometimes successfully, sometimes not so successfully. But basically, for years and years, at least when I was coming of age, there was either your local dirt weed or California weed, and everybody knew about it. And, you know, because of the conditions and the environment for growing it, and the fact that people have been growing it forever, and weren't a bunch of teenagers sitting in their father's garage trying to, you know, come up with something. And now, you know, really for almost the last 10 years, there's marijuana growing all over the United States, legally, right? In a number of states that have come on board and said medical, adult use. Has the presence of a legal market, and even in California, talk to us about what that's done to your business, as well as your thoughts on the stuff you can produce versus the stuff that they're producing.
First of all, I mean, for all the headaches of this like broken system that I feel like we've been going through since legalization, it's better for us as a farmer and it's better for the consumers. You know, testing is a big thing, because cannabis can look pretty and you will not know what was used on it. How was it grown? And so pesticides, like illegal pesticides, harmful pesticides, stuff that becomes carcinogenic at temperature, you know, Floramite, Eagle 20, these things that, you know, not until you put a lighter to the bud does it turn carcinogenic. You know, these are the same things that they spray on our food, you know, supply. So, you know, the FDA sees it as okay for our food, but, you know, not for our cannabis. So I would say, you know, that the health and safety factor for the consumers, by far better. The science behind all of this is making us better farmers. It's more educated consumers. I mean, we're starting to study terpenes, what terpenes are in what plant and why, what different environmental factors are affecting terpenes, the whole entourage effect, you know, what's this doing? I'm not a THC chaser. Some brands, you know, just chase the THC, and that's a whole other issue with the legal side of things because of, you know, discrepancies in lab testing and everybody, you know, promoting high numbers, even if they're falsified, that whole chaos that's being checked right now.
That's what I want to ask you about.
Yeah. No, it's rampant.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I started smoking weed in 1980. And when we smoked weed in 1980, we were just happy to get our hands on weed, right? For all we knew, it could have been a handful of dirt that somebody threw in a baggie. But for us, it was like, you know, it was great stuff. And then all through college and through my early adult years and really up until the legal market really burst on the scene, I had never heard of a terpene. I had no idea what a terpene was. All of a sudden, I talked to my kids about weed, to them, oh, Dad, the terpene profile, the terpene. I'm like, I just want to get high, right? But, I mean, and I know a lot of these legal businesses are coming in with their scientists and everything to maximize terpene, and you start seeing THC counts that get close to 40%, which I can't even imagine. But, I mean, for you guys, what do you do to keep up with all of this new science, you know, the terpenes and THC and you know, THCA and everything that's coming out now?
I mean, you know, I've been in this for 30 something years, and you know, you learn something new every day. There's and yay, you know, I don't ever want to hit that ceiling. You know, I mean, it keeps things interesting. It keeps things, you know, creative. You know, last year we grew 50 different genetics. We work with a couple different seed companies, the Humboldt Seed Company, Happy Dreams Genetics. We do some stuff in-house. And so we're doing pheno hunting all the time. We have three different microclimates that we grow on. Each one of those microclimates has a whole different terroir. That, you know, the whole concept of like appellations when it comes to like wine, let's talk about craft wine. There's such a parallel because cannabis and wine, they grow on the same cycles, the same climates, really bring out their best expressions. What we're seeing is, you know, we can take the same genetic and grow it in three different microclimates, you know, in our area, and have different expressions through the terpenes. And so you're getting a little bit different flavor profile. You're getting a little bit different effect. And this is the same genetics. And this is just on our farm footprint, let alone, you know, driving 3 hours inside the county to another friend's farm, or sending it 7 hours down the state and growing it in, you know, Salinas or Santa Barbara or something like that. So it's very indicative of where you grow each strain and how it expresses itself. Just because it says OG does not mean you're going to get the same experience from an OG from me as you are my neighbor that's maybe, you know, 10 miles away. And so that science right there, you know, it really teaches us what to grow, where and why, and how to really bring out the best of each flower. And some strains don't need to be grown at one of our locations. They do better somewhere else. And we're, you know, constantly rotating.
So that's what I wanted to ask you. You know, you live in an area where there's a lot of growers around. you know, do you guys like gather in the bar on Friday nights and start swapping stories, or hey, try doing it this, or is it more of a competitive thing and people kind of hold on to their own secrets?
No, that's how it used to be. It used to be a little bit more competitive. You know, if you met at the bar, you met with your friends and you kept your head down, again, because the penalties were so severe. So you didn't really talk about it like we have since legalization's happened. And the advent of everything, you know, hitting on, you know, social media and those kind of things. And what I love about that is I've connected with farmers that have the same ethos as I do, that have the same vision for Humboldt County as I do, in other parts of the county that I wouldn't be interacting with without, you know, this new interface. And, you know, you kind of touched on, well, you're up here with all these farms. You know, before legalization, 2015, we had 15,000 mapped farms in Humboldt County. You know, we have, I think, like 1,100 active licenses and maybe 700 active sites right now. And most of those are 10,000 square feet or less footprints. That's tiny. That's less than a quarter acre. If you add up all the canopy in Humboldt County right now, all of the total canopy of all the farms, and we're a large county, I believe it's like a half mile by a half mile total canopy. Very small footprint. You know, so we've really lost a lot of quality farms. We also lost a lot that just came during the green rush that needed to leave anyway.
So, Nick, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned, you know, having an ethos as a grower. And you and I talked a little bit about that when we first met in San Francisco. So I'd like to hear a little bit about that. But what I'd also like to hear about is what success you guys have had, if any, in competitions, Emerald Cup or Cannabis Cup type things, or, you know, other awards that are given in the industry, whether, you know, you guys have gotten any of those.
Yeah. So as far as ethos is concerned, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, quality of product through environmental consciousness, you know, I mean, we have about 750,000 gallons of above tank rain catchment storage, about another 5 million gallons in rain catchment in ponds that we use for our irrigation. You know, there's no artificial lighting, you know, it's all organic inputs. Our fertilizers are all based, you know, in sea kelps that are sustainably harvested, you know, fish emulsions, crab meals, things like that. So we really look at our inputs and we want our inputs to be reflected in the output of the flower and the quality of the flower and the expressions it gives us at the season's end. We've entered, four different competitions and we've won, two awards in each of them, in the Emerald Cup, Feast of Flowers, the Golden Tarps, the California Grow Off, those kind of things. But, you know, honestly, for us, you know, the real reward is having somebody that we don't know reach out to us and go, hey, you know, we found your product, we really enjoyed it, and we're coming back to get it again, or have a bud tender let us know that somebody drove twice this week from an hour away to purchase an eighth, you know, something like that. It's like, wow, that's the real, you know, testament right there, because, you know, packaging and awards are just one thing, but, you know, repeat customers because of quality, you know, I mean, it's much like the restaurant industry. You have a bad meal, you're probably not coming back. And so we really want to maintain that standard of quality. And it's not necessarily, you know, chasing THC percentages or bag appeal, because some of the best experiences that I've had from flower, the flowers look pretty generic in general, just the sun-grown kind of bag appeal. But we do focus on terpenes because we want your experience to be what it should be for you. When you walk into a dispensary, there seems to always be like the top 10 fad strains that are being pushed on everybody. A lot of bud tenders don't even smoke the house brand that they represent, you know, so there's a big disconnect from what the farms are trying to do for the consumer versus what is being pushed by, you know, the industry. And, you know, like I said, this year we grew 50 different genetics. You know, they're not the best yielding genetics. We, you know, we're leaving money on the table for sure because we're not chasing yields. We're not, you know, we have stuff that tests low 20s, maybe high teens, but has a very high terpene percentage to it. And we want to find something for the individual. We grow for the individual. It's just trying to get that information out there and give people options. You know, some people want to be energized and, in, you know, invigorated and have it be a communicative experience. Other people want to check out at the end of the day and just hit the couch and unwind. You know, people don't want to feel anxious and stressed. And so we really want to like kind of correlate what terpenes are in what flowers and kind of steer those flowers towards the right person for the right reason. It's not, you know, we're so individualistic. It's just, there's not one strain for everybody. And we understand that.
But that's kind of cool, isn't it? You know, you walk into a dispensary and there's your stuff being offered for sale and people are buying it. Where can our listeners who live in California go to find your stuff?
Retail-wise, you know, we're in the Embark chains, we're in the Spark chains, you know, Pioneer Wellness down at in Clear Lake. You know, we also have a very amazing direct-to-consumer partner with Flower Company. They just acquired Muse. So it's the largest direct-to-consumer platform in the state of California now. This just happened about a month ago. So we are able to be delivered door-to-door from San Diego to Humboldt County, usually under 24 hours, sometimes same day, depending on how close you are to the hub. So we have a partner, my neighboring farm, a very small footprint farm called Humboldt County Farms. He is working on kind of a co-op style model for similar farms like mine. And we're just pushing the Humboldt brand. You were kind of alluding to competition earlier. Not at all. When I see anybody in a retail environment or in any cannabis space purchase or talk about craft farms in general, that's a win for all of us, and that's also in Mendocino and Trinity and, you know, Santa Cruz area where these legacy operators, the ones that are surviving still are, because all of us during the green rush experienced a surplus of subpar cannabis. Everybody got in it for the wrong reasons. They were just chasing the money. They drove the quality down. Well, the money disappeared in the industry for the last few years. So if you're still in it at this point as a legacy operator, you have to have craft to maintain, because otherwise you're in the commodity market. You're not going to keep up. You're not going to win that war. So, you know, the craft farmers are definitely on the same side. And, you know, each one of us, our supply is so much lower than the big boys, you know, Glasshouse and those guys that are, you know, whatever it is, 600,000 pounds they claimed last year, something like that, which, you know, there's only 1,200 licensed stores in the state, right? So, I mean, not everybody wants that chemical commodity. You know, we're kind of alluding to every state that's coming out right now, there's just this novelty of this abundance, cheap cannabis. And it's everywhere and it's cheap, but it doesn't mean it's good. And so we just want to spread the word about quality. You know, the small farms that actually care about their land, care about the plant, because this cannabis, and I can't, you know, understate this. It's a plant that gives you back what you put in. It's like a relationship. You know, if you give it your A effort, it will give you its A effort back. And, you know, if you want to cut corners, it will still produce for you, but it's going to cut corners also. And you just see that time and time again.
Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense, too. And I can certainly understand, you know, your desire to do it that way. Just one last question, focusing on the marijuana side before we shift over to a little bit of music. But, you know, with all of these, you know, the states going legal and everything, and it seemed for a while as though the regular, you know, prices of marijuana, at least the ones we were all used to, were going to kind of be the same. But over the last few months, we've seen tremendous fluctuations in prices. In some states, you know, you can get ounces now under $100. And how can anybody be competitive, you know, when you're dealing in a market where prices, you know, an ounce is dipping below $100?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? Or the lack of having $1 million. No, it's, you know, I was in it when I was purchasing pounds myself at $5,200 a pound, you know, and trying to make money at it. You know, now we're operating and everybody's having to sharpen their pencil and figure this out and adapt and compete with these commodity prices but have a better product to make it to market. You know, if we're able to operate in that $400 to $500 range and be per pound and be profitable on the wholesale bulk market, well, you know, what's that translate into? I mean, $50 an ounce, you know, is still $800 a pound. You know, so it's there, you know, minus the taxes and, you know, and how many people are, you know, taking their bite out down the food chain. That's why we like the direct to consumer model, because we're in control of our quality and our supply. we can send out smaller batches, fresher batches, more frequently that are maintained in a climate-controlled room closer to the consumer. We'll sell through these smaller batches and then just re-up. That way, they're not being disappointed. They're getting better value. We're still getting paid because, you know, what Dan and I were talking there when you took your time out was like, you know, getting the money back up the food chain to the farmers also is a huge problem. You know, every one of the farms has had non-payment issues. And, you know, we were just talking about grass doors shutting down. I think it was $7 million owed to their vendors. I mean, that's a massive ripple effect in a community like mine. You know, we don't have these venture capitalists backing us. You know, a lot of these big MSOs that are operating in the state are going through these fluctuations. Well, you know, investors don't like to see contraction markets. So as those valves get turned off, we're watching more and more of these bigger brands fall off. And you know, they're renting these high lease, you know, storefronts and prime real estate and that whole kind of thing. But if it's not translating into dollars, you know, we're just seeing this like ebb and flow. It's like an accordion right now, and we're just trying to ride these waves and make it through. But we know in our heart, you know, we got passion for what we do. You know, quality always finds a path, and you know, we're staying true to the roots like that.
Very nice. Well, I, you know, there's so much more on marijuana I really feel like we could talk about, but I want to shift our focus over to music a little bit just for a second, or not a second, but for a few minutes here, because that is definitely part of the identity of our show, and you fit right into that side really well. Tell us about the kind of marriage that you've created between, you know, your business and the music industry.
Well, you know, cannabis has always opened doors. You know, it's opened doors that I would have never had open to me had I not been in cannabis, you know, even from the 90s. And so, you know, we used to work with a lot of, you know, musicians and athletes and politicians and those kind of things when nobody wanted to talk about it. You know, there wasn't a lot of questions brought up. It was just, you know, those doors were open very early on. So I knew that we were in the right business, right? It was a connector, you know, and cannabis is, it's a connector. And it's, you know, it's not like, you know, being an outlaw farmer is much different than, you know, a typical drug dealer, right? I mean, you're operating with a very different experience, a different substance, right? This is cannabis. You know, they're using cannabis now to get people off of opiates. You know, it's being used in rehab centers, those type of things. But anyway, you know, we've you know, garnished friendships inside the music industry and the sports world and things like that through cannabis. And, you know, bringing the green to the green rooms, you know, we've been lucky enough to be invited into a lot of behind the scenes scenarios. And, you know, just because a musician is carrying a guitar case and touring doesn't mean that they're also independently wealthy. There's a lot of struggling tour musicians, and they're very grateful for some quality flower to show up backstage. And it's just nice having that interaction. You know, we're not out there, you know, with that avenue trying to make money or anything like that. We definitely want to be whatever kind of positive influence that we can on the music, because the music has always been a positive influence on us. So that whole synergetic, that vibe, that synergy there is just, it's amazing, you know, and to see somebody, you know, use our product and go out there and crush the set and have the sound engineer tap you and say, hey man, second set was rocking, man, like, good job, you know, that, and they've got a critical ear, and I'm not a musician, you know, I'm just a fan, you know, of and a very eclectic fan of all sorts of music, but, so it's nice, you know, and then we're, again, you know, tailoring strains to certain people. You know, everybody wants something different and sure, not real heavy. So we've been doing a lot of CBD blends, those kind of things. And but it's cool to watch people get creative after partaking of something that we created.
For sure. Now, I know from our conversations that you've, you know, had occasions where you met Bob Weir, for instance. Tell us about that. What was he like?
Oh, he's amazing. You know, so we had a mutual friend that worked with him in like a consulting realm. And the first time I met him was like my friend texted me about 7:30 in the morning and said, hey, I need to call you in about 5 minutes. That's all I had. I was still in bed. I was groggy, didn't pre-caffeinated, hair flying everywhere. So I started to get up. Literally about 10 seconds later, the phone's ringing. It's my buddy Steve, and he's FaceTiming me. So I'm climbing out of bed half naked, my hair flying. I hit FaceTime. It's Bob. I'm just staring at Bob. I'm like, what is going on here? I'm like, what am I looking at here? I'm trying to wax my hair down here, and I'm like, you know, I ended up in my room was a mess. I'm like walking out back so I could get the redwoods in the background. I'm trying to rub the sleep out of my eyes. I'm just clueless of what's going on. And he wanted to talk about CBD topicals just because, you know, he had some issues with his hands and his shoulder, you know, packing instruments around so many years. And so we just kind of talked a little bit about CBD, and he was just great and gracious. And he said, hey, why don't you just, you know, come on down to the Sweetwater. You know, the Wolf Brothers were going to be doing a warm-up pre-tour. And so we came down and got to kick it with the boys. And Big Steve was there, MCN, and just listening to him talk like friends, you know, and just that whole just fly on the wall. I was just blown away because just absorbing that environment. And he invited me up to his house the next day where the picture I sent you was from. And got to check out his guitar collection and stuff, and gave him some CBD water and some salve and stuff, and just tried to, you know, just trying to help out with the aches and pains. A total positive, you know, just whatever we can do to help him, because he's, you know, surrounded by people that need things and want things, and that's not us. You know, we want to be the person that can help and give something back. And I mean, obviously, being a deadhead, you know, the music has given us so much and shaped our lives in so many ways and formed friendships with, you know, within the dead circles. And and just a weird coincidence, little side note on that, you being in Chicago, a deadhead that I met from Philadelphia in line at the Chicago shows just sent me a Chicago deep dish overnight, and I thought about you and how poignant that was today. I'm like, oh man, Larry's been calling from Chicago, and I just had a deep dish like next day to me today. So thank you, Dana.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Anyway, yeah. So he was great. He was very gracious, very down to earth, and just like it was wonderful. It was wonderful, and just, you know, just talking like you know, he'd known you his whole life.
That's wonderful. But within the Grateful Dead family, you've also had run-ins with guys like Rob Bleedstein and David Gans.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, we do work with the Haight Street Art Center. You know, we'll help them with their openers on some of their galleries, and anybody that's down in the city, you know, they have such amazing stuff coming through there. It's a nonprofit, but it's all things music, you know. And so they were doing an Herb Green exhibit, so it was just everything Herb Green, and you know, we had a little table at the front, so anybody, it was a VIP type experience. Anybody coming in could get cannabis bags from us, and so we talked cannabis, talked music, got to meet Dave that night, I don't know if you've seen his new book, Improvised Lives. It's Grateful Dead 72 to 85, I think, but he's got some great interviews where he's like got, you know, Bobby hanging upside down, you know, from these workout boots, and he's interviewing him upside down and that type of thing. And and Dave's, you know, and he's a big fan of cannabis as well. So, you know, we had these, you know, right off the get goes, you know, cannabis interfacing, and started running circles around, and Rob as well. I mean, Rob's a big stoner, you know, he's like me, California sober, you know. It's just, weed and some psychedelics. And, you know, I have been drinking now in about 5 months and feeling good about it. And, you know, he's been on that train a lot longer, you know, Rob likes his one little hobby plant or two hobby plants in the backyard, and so he's been growing some of the forbidden grapes from us, and he's loving that. And he's a good guy. You know, every time we bump into him, he's always throwing us like some live, you know, CD from New Riders, or you know, poking us with something special for sure. He's a special guy. We really like our friendship with him.
Yeah, they're both great. Rob and David have both been guests on the show, and both just fascinating people, you know, and the kind of guys when you sit around and you say, boy, wouldn't it be cool to be David Gans, you know? And what I love is, you know, how he talks about how, here I am, you know, if you ask me what my game plan was, you know, to become this associated with the Grateful Dead family, I don't know that I could have told you, but here it is. And that's one of the things I loved about the Grateful Dead always, was the organic way in which, you know, so many people just kind of found themselves becoming part of the family. You know, if there was a role you could fill, if you were the right kind of personality, if, you know, as long as you were bringing positive energy and stuff like that, you know, and for all of us deadheads, you know, who don't have the luxury of living in that part of the world where you could bump into somebody in the grocery store, maybe, you know, we just all, oh my God, you know, and the closest I think I ever came was in 1985. We were out at the Greek Theater for the 20th anniversary shows, and that Saturday or Sunday, also happened to be the Haight Street Fair. So a group of us went over there, and we were sitting in Panhandle Park right there at the end of Haight Street, and we were rolling some joints, and all of a sudden we looked up, and there were two security dudes standing right there. And we're like, oh boy, you guys rolling those joints? Yes, we are, sir. Yes, yes. Okay, well, I need a few of them. The guys backstage say they need some joints. And it was Bobby was backstage, and Brent was backstage, and a few of the other. And I was like, can we go backstage with you and give? No. They want some joints, so we need some joints. So we handed them some joints, and off they went. And, you know, all I'm thinking about was, I hope they were good joints. But then I thought, he doesn't know who I am, so I guess I'm clear either way.
That's awesome. I love that. Absolutely. Yeah. That is one thing. You know, there's so many talented musicians that interplay with each other too, down in the Bay Area, East Bay, the city, Marin. You know, that whole scene down there is amazing. You know, I have a buddy that was down Mill Valley the other day and was pumping gas next to Carlos Santana. You know, it's just like, oh, there's Carlos. You know, it's just that kind of thing. Yeah. And it's awesome, you know, because everybody plays with each other too. You know, they all sit in and just, you know, it's wild. You know, we went and caught the Warfield 100th anniversary with Phil and friends, you know, and I went in that one, watched that show completely sober, and I had happy tears in my eyes. I mean, that show was just amazing. You know, that was the late James Casey. You know, his voice is phenomenal, and the Dear Prudence, I mean, it just, he had the room mesmerized. You know, I mean, it's just stuff like that. You know, Eric Krasnow, you know, watching him play, I mean, in my eyes, he's, you know, top 10 guitarist right now, and just love what he does, and phenomenal work. And yeah, it's fun. You get to see a lot of live music in small, intimate venues, and that's what's cool. It's not all stadium stuff.
And to me, that's such a difference. You know, where, like, my kids are taking me to Fish Festival this summer out in Delaware. You know, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I've taken a liking to Fish lately, you know, but you hear about the old days when they were playing in small theaters, and when the Dead were playing in small theaters. And, you know, when I go to see bands that are playing in small theaters, and all I can do is sit there and just say, imagine, you know, you were in here and this is the room the Dead showed up in one night, or Phil and Friends. And I happen to love Phil and Friends. You know, Dead and Co. is great, and all the others are great, but there's something about Phil Lesh and John Molo. And then when he has the quintet with him, right? Herring and Warren Haynes and Rob Baracco. But then I've seen him, you know, with other guys, including Casey and the other two women on the horns, and that's just as amazing too.
Jennifer and Natalie Cressman. I got in from the farm too late. Jennifer played here last night, and it's rare, you know, when you get, you know, a nice beacon show up here, and I just got in too late to catch her, so I missed that. Sorry, Jennifer, but yeah, she. That's one downside of being 3 hours, you know, 4 hours away from anything. You know, we catch the shows that are usually, you know, people playing in the Bay Area and Portland, and they pit stop here, you know, on their way, you know.
So here, I've just for no reason, but we talked about this when we first met. I want to shift gears a little bit and ask you about Jimmy Page and Robert Plant and a tour that they did in the 90s.
Yeah.
And you were telling me a story about how a group of you were kind of following that tour as well. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. You know, so I mean, we were living out of, like I said, living out of a van. And so the same way we were taking on Dead tour, we'd followed Page and Plant on both their tours from LA up to, you know, Seattle. And I also grew up a big Led Zeppelin fan, and I had a license plate that said One Zep Fan on it. And, you know, we got our tickets. They were their first show. Their first tour was the old LA Forum where the Lakers used to play. And, you know, I would read all the books. They had two tour managers, and then, you know, Neil Preston, their photographer. And I kept up on, you know, Jimmy Page was a collector of music memorabilia. So a lot of stuff he did, he would design for collectors, you know, like the Physical Graffiti album, having the sliding windows, and the Coda album going into the packaging, you know, the sleeve and those kind of things. So, you know, I was young, 18, 19, whatever. And I had this grandiose idea of, you know, my contact with a rock legend like Jimmy Page. So I took my license plate off my truck, wrote my information on the back. I think I wrote my dad's, you know, house number on there, because I didn't even have a cell phone or a phone at the time. And, you know, just said, okay, well, I'm going to get down there and throw this thing on stage, and he's going to hold it up. He's going to keep it in his personal collection, and then I'll probably get something pretty cool sent to me. And I just had this, you know, this total off the wall dream, you know, And so we got down to LA, and we had super cheap tickets. And, you know, up till then, everything was general admission, so we were used to GA. And as we were walking in, we had a bag of mushrooms and got into those. And, you know, we had ushers pointing us to where we needed to sit, which wasn't ideal at all. It was basically our backs were against the concrete at the top of the third tier up there. And the stage just looked like a postage stamp. I was just like, well, this isn't going to work at all. And the mushrooms started kicking in, the lights went down, and I ran down the stairs, and there was a drop-off to the floor, which was all seats. It wasn't standing. It was all seated. And everybody was standing, but, you know, they all still had seats there. And I dropped down and had security chase me into the crowd. And at the time, I was probably only 140 pounds, so I was squirrely. And I was going over people's chairs and shoulders and, you know, worked my way up dead center, row two. And a bank corporation had bought like 10 seats and some people didn't show up. So they let me sit there with them and they took turns holding my license plate up and you know, got to watch the whole show, just having a great time. And, you know, I was telling them about my master plan of getting the plate on stage during the encore and this and that. You know, I'm peaking pretty good, and the encore comes, and it's there was two layers to the stage. And Jimmy Page came out with his double neck, you know, and the bow, and they got into cashmere, and he starts doing that classic riff with his bow, and they brought out the LA Philharmonic was on the second tier, and it was just loaded, and I got all amped up and threw my license plate, and it took off like a frisbee. It went right over Jimmy Page's head. It went to the second deck, and it hit this poor old lady on the violin right in the throat, and she dropped her violin. The guy next to her stopped playing his violin to help her, and before I could even say, oh, shit, I had security guards just jumping the rail after me. I was only two rows back, so I had to turn, like, in my haze, you know, from elation to fear, and boogie through the crowd to get away from these guys. But, you know, I never got arrested, but I never got an autograph either, so that was my fame to shame story.
Wow. Now, did you ever have a chance to meet those guys?
No, never did. I did bump into Robert Plant one time down in Costa Rica, and he was flip-flopping along with a lady, and you know, nobody recognized him. I knew who he was, and he kind of just gave me he saw that. He made eye contact and kind of gave me the hand, like, hey, you know, hold off, I'm chilling, kind of thing. And that was cool. I just didn't invade his space. Let him be him and do his thing. But that was the only time that I saw him after that.
Okay. And when was the first time?
Oh, no, Robert and Alison Krauss are playing the Frost Theater out here, I think, like late August, early September.
Yeah.
So we will play, you know, get down there and see that one.
No license plates.
No license plates this time, I promise. Maybe a 14-gram joint. I'll be more friendly about it this time.
Okay. When was the first time you saw the Grateful Dead?
God, that was, I think, Cal Expo, 92, 3. I got on, so, you know, I graduated in 93. I got turned on to them probably mid-80s, 85, 86, from, you know, friends, brothers and sisters type of thing, passing tapes down. You know, I kind of was in that era of, like, you know, Built to Last and In the Dark and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, that era, those later Dead tapes. You know, when I started seeing them in the 90s, I didn't have anything to calibrate to. You know, I didn't see them in the 70s or with Brent, you know. And it was just mind-blowing coming out of high school, you know, what the scene had turned into. And you know, looking back on it now, you know, I realized that the band was like, oh, shit, it's out of control. And, you know, people were saying they weren't playing their best music in the 90s. But at the time, I was just floored. I was just like, look at this. I mean, there's as many people out in the parking lot that didn't get in that got in, you know, and it's just like you don't have to leave the parking lot. You can barter for everything. It was just this like utopian society. And like, I was in, I was all in, you know, I jumped on that bus and didn't want to look back. And, so even, you know, that era of the Dead, you know, it still had me. And, you know, and I'm thankful for it to this day. And so, you know, like I said, you know, getting to meet Bob and all this, it just, you know, he sees it every day. You know, we definitely don't, you know, from our perspective. And it was a beautiful thing.
That's wonderful. That's really, really cool, man. Nick, I'm having a great time, and notwithstanding the little technical problems I had there, which I apologize again for, I would blame Dan, but everybody knows it's me anyway, so it doesn't matter. But we're going to have to stop for today. We're reaching our limit here. But I feel like, you know, there's so much more we have to talk about that I hope you'll be willing to come back on again in the future you know, and pick right back up so we can just get into more great stories.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For sure. I would be honored. I mean, thank you for having me on. Like I said, you know, I'm a big listener of the show and I'm always learning something new. So hopefully that translated well for your listeners today. And you know, there's always so much to touch on in the cannabis world. It's ever changing. There's always something to touch on in the music world that's ever changing. Speaking of, did you see Don Ross dropped his new band yesterday? What's it? The Pan Detroit Ensemble. So he's going on tour.
I love him too. There's, you know, the beauty of it is there's so much good live music out there that eventually I just run out of time to see it all.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, really what's available and where you can go and find it is just outstanding.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Really, really love it. Well, listen, man, thank you so much. What a pleasure to have you on the show. Nick Erickson, everyone. Our guest today from Full Moon Farms in California. If you've already tried his products, hopefully you like it and you'll tell people. If you haven't tried them yet, hopefully now you'll go try it out and then tell all your friends about how good it is. Take it with you to concerts, pass it around. Anything we can do to help Nick is also cool too, because, you know, he's one of those guys who's out there doing it for all of us. He takes the risks, we get the benefits. So it's a great thing. Thank you again, sir. As we head out today, there was not a lot of music, but I will dip into this concert that we're featuring today back from 1972 at the New York Academy of Music. And as I promised, a little bit of Pigpen on the way out the door today. Next time you see me, it's a blues song written by Earl Forrest and Bill Harvey, originally recorded in 1956 by Junior Parker. Next time you see me was one of the blues and R&B songs that Pigpen brought into the Grateful Dead repertoire at the beginning of their formation. The song with Pigpen on vocals and harmonica became part of their concerts, regularly played in concerts by 1967. According to one of the Dead's biographers, Oliver Traeger, they performed two different versions. He describes one as a driving up-tempo rendition, and the other is a somewhat rarer and moodier take sung as a duet with Jerry Garcia. I don't know that I've ever heard that one. The group often played the song in the early 1970s, and live recordings were included on several albums, such as 100 Year Hall from the April 26, 1972 Europe Tour, the Europe 72 Volume 2 set, Rockin' the Rhine with the Grateful Dead. And you'll notice most of these are coming from the Europe 72 period, when Pig was singing it quite frequently. And this is probably his warm-up, as we say, the last show before they go. The first time they ever played it was February 25th, 1966 at the Ivar Theater in L.A. The last time coincided with the end of the Europe 72 tour at the Lyceum Ballroom in London. They played it a total of 81 times. Be sure to listen not only to Pig's singing, but to his harp playing at the end. It's great stuff. You're going to love it. Thank you again to our friend Nick. Thanks to Dan Humiston, as always. Everyone have a great week. Be safe. And as always, enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thank you.
Listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
How do cannabis CEOs balance growth and optimization strategies? What is THCO, Delta 10, and CBNA, and why should you care about these minor cannabinoids? And why isn't the endocannabinoid system covered in medical school? Most people think they're up to date in trends in the cannabis industry, but they're about 6 weeks behind. Learn about what is truly next in the cannabis space by joining myself, Brian Fields, and Kellen Finney every week on the Dime Podcast and, of course, on PodConnects.